Hey there, and welcome to Making Positive Psychology Work, the weekly podcast where we uncover tested practical ways to help people move from functioning to flourishing at work, so together we can better navigate the incredible challenges and opportunities our world faces. I'm your host, Michelle McQuaid, and what you probably don't know about me is that I left home at the grand old age of 16 because I was so sure I knew more about living life than my parents did. Oh dear. Thank you so much for joining me for lesson number 45 of Making Positive Psychology Work in partnership with the Positive Business Conference coming up on May the 11th and 12th in Ann Arbor at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business. I'm so glad you're here because today we're talking to Sue Ashford, one of the conference speakers and a professor in management and organization whose research interests include leader effectiveness and development, issue selling, self-management and feedback processes in organisations. She's taught in numerous executive development programs, consulted to many organisations, including General Electric and Merrill Lynch, and her research has been published in academic journals and business publications, including the Academy of Management Journal and the Harvard Business Review. But what you probably don't know about Sue is that when she was 19, she rode her bike from Vancouver to her childhood home in Los Angeles with her best friend. Welcome, Sue.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm very well. And Sue, it's great to have you with us today because I know you are busily preparing for your workshop on Control Your Own Destiny, Leadership Development Through Mindful Engagement for the upcoming Positive Business Conference. So what are you hoping people will take away from your session?
My fondest hope is that people leave the session inspired to manage and grow their own leadership. I think we sometimes reinforce in organizations that people should wait around to be tapped as having potential and sent somewhere to do work on leadership and experience growth in leadership. I think everyone has leadership potential, and I think that this session helps put the agency in their hands so that they can take control of it.
Do you find for people, so that can be hard though, when they feel like leadership is something the organization has to assign? And if I assign it to myself, how might people respond to that?
Well, I do think people need to be sensitive to the context and what the context will allow, tolerate, what it demands. But I do think leadership is in part just a mindset. For example, a colleague has a friend who is an Army officer and he retired to take a position within a company. And he set up an iPhone app so that every day when he got there around 5:30, his phone said, "Leadership in everything I do today." There's another executive, a partner at Booz & Company, and she said, "To stand out and excel, especially as a woman in the business world, you need to lead. Think of yourself as a leader first and a consultant, designer, engineer, et cetera, second." And I think what they mean by this is you need to lead your own life so that you are creating the best you can for the organization and the best you can for yourself. And you also need to be thinking about your impact on others, how you can draw others in, all of which is part of leadership from wherever you sit in an organization.
So Sue, I know you've written a couple of articles about the leadership talent shortage that so many companies are experiencing.
I think it's part skill, it's part mindset, and it's in part the risk. So the skill part is there is a skill element to leadership. You know, you can learn to be more inspirational. You can learn to be more multi-focused, not just task-focused, but also people-focused. So those are skills you can learn, skills of being a leader, setting a vision, those kinds of things. And then part of it, though, is mindset. You know, it's how we think about leadership. And if you think about leadership as a there and then thing that you'll take up once you're a division head or a CEO, then you don't think about the myriad ways you could lead now. You think of that as not relevant to me. And so that mindset gets in the way of leading. And then the third part is leadership is not without risk. In our research, we've identified three types of risk that people perceive in leadership and that concern them and that we've shown deter them from being a leader. One is interpersonal risk. Like if I try to lead and other people in the team want to lead, we might have conflict. There's also image risk. Like I might try to lead, but I might do it in an awkward way, and my image might take a hit, for example. And then the third kind of risk is what we call instrumental risk. And it's the fear that whatever happens in the group gets attributed to the leader. We know that research on how people think about things. And if the group product fails, I don't want to be the leader. And you see this a lot of times when groups start on a highly risky project. There's a lot of suggestions in the group that other people might lead, right, rather than individuals stepping up to lead themselves. A mindful engagement is really a set of practices that allow people to learn more from the experiences they're in. And leadership is one of the things they could learn. They could be learning anything. But leadership is kind of an important one because it's a complex skill, and it's a skill that is somewhat subjectively evaluated. Your idea of what is a good leader might be very different than my idea, for example. But it's based, the idea is based on the findings that leaders report learning 70% of what they know that enables them to be a good leader. They learned it from experiences they had rather than going to a course. Or they also note that about 20% is from other people, you know, people that they observe, role models, or people they interacted with. So a lot of leadership we learn on the job. But one of the observations we made when we came up with this set of ideas about mindful engagement is that two people could go through the same experience and learn very different amounts depending on how they acted in that experience. So one of the things we noted is that people are often beating through their lives somewhat mindlessly. I often ask people, have you ever eaten mindlessly? And people usually say yes. And they often say yes to, have you ever driven mindlessly, gotten from point A to point B, and you can't quite remember how you did that? There's even a joke about, have you ever interacted mindlessly? And there's a little cartoon that said, it's been ages since we interacted mindlessly to each other's stories over drinks. And so the starting point for this set of ideas is that we don't learn from experience because we're often not even in our experiences. We're racing through them somewhat mindlessly. And so if you learn leadership mostly from experience, but you're racing through your experiences mindlessly, you're leaving a lot of learning on the table. Learning that would help you to be effective at this kind of ambiguous, more art form that is leadership.
I think most of us can resonate with the challenges and the costs of being mindless in our interactions with others. So, Sue, how can we practice mindful engagement?
The way I look at it is we are not ever going to be mindful every moment of our day or in every experience. But we could decide to approach certain experiences in a more mindful way. And that's what this set of practices is about. So in my workshops, I invite people to identify an upcoming experience. It might be that you're being sent overseas for a six-month assignment. It might be that you're instituting a new kind of meeting for you and your team. So a variety, having a difficult conversation, a variety of upcoming experiences. The idea then is once you have an experience in mind, if you could work on a couple of things as you approach that experience, you're going to learn more. And there's three that we identify. One is to work on your mindset. And I don't know if you've talked in your podcast about Carol Dweck's work on mindset.
Absolutely. In fact, we interviewed Carol about two sessions ago, and reading your research, I was like, oh, is this growth mindset intersecting with mindful leadership? So absolutely.
Exactly. Yes. So Carol identifies the power of engaging experiences with a growth mindset or a learning orientation. Basically, the idea is to go into the experience saying, I hope to grow. How can I grow in this experience? Or how can I learn in this experience? And the contrasting mindset is one where you're just totally fixated on performing and showing others that you can do well in this experience. So we talk about in my workshop, we talk about a little incident with my daughter where she came home. She's starting teaching in a very challenging school. And she came home and said, Mom, next week, two of the best teachers in the school are coming to observe me in the classroom. And if you have a learning orientation about that, you would think certain thoughts. And if you have a performance orientation, your thoughts would be very different. So with the learning orientation, you might think, oh, good, I'll probably get great feedback. If you have a performance orientation, you will spend your entire holiday prepping for that session so that you can prove, even though you're only 4 months on the job, how great you are at teaching. And we fall into performant mindset all the time because we think every situation is critical and we have to prove. But the ironic thing is someone who goes through life working on proving over and over again that they are great actually learns less and ultimately is less great than the person who goes through with more of a learning orientation. So the mindset part is just checking how you're thinking about the upcoming event. But that's really step one.
So talk us through step two. How do we get from that mindset, that approach to it, into the action of what we need to be doing?
Step two is really thinking about what might be a developmental goal that I could work on in this experience. You know, you're going to go through the experience anyway. You're going to run the retreat or have the difficult conversation or go overseas, and you're going to be attending to the content of that experience. But another thread that could be considered to be woven through that experience is you, your behavior, your effectiveness. So what about that could you set as a goal? So it's kind of like, where do you need to improve? I like to phrase it as, what would you need to do to be the person your dog already thinks you are? And I have a great picture of a dog looking at you, knowing you're perfect in every way. But you know you're not. You know there's a learning edge. So maybe it's you don't really listen when people talk, or maybe it's you're not very approachable, or maybe it's you need to work on being more influential. And so, you know, if you were to set a goal that you could be working on in addition to doing the task of the experience, you're much more likely to learn something about you in that experience on this dimension that you've identified.
It makes perfect sense. And looking at your research on this and how it was described as active experimentation, it was also reminding me of some of the research around the value of play. And I know many organizations encouraging their leaders in the practices of design thinking, for example, right now. Are these elements of how we can get in and more actively experiment as we're taking action?
Well, I hadn't thought about that connection to design thinking. The way I think about experimentation starts from the quote on insanity that's attributed to Einstein, which is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result is the definition of insanity. So the idea is that if you want to try to grow on this dimension, one thing you might do is to experiment with some different ways of going at the experience so you can see what works and doesn't work. So for example, if you want to work on being more influential, you might try speaking first in the meeting, or you might try speaking last. You might try speaking softly so that everyone's drawn in, or speaking in a voice tone that doesn't rise at the end in a question mark, or sitting in a particular place to try to be a little bit more influential. But the idea is to try different things so that you can see what might help you better achieve your goal.
That makes perfect sense. And I know the other thing in this action step in your model that was really resonating with me, and thinking about a lot of the leaders that I work with who struggle sometimes on this front, is the need for emotional regulation as we're doing that experimentation. So can you talk to us a little bit about how that plays into this step?
Right. You know, anxiety is not our friend in most experiences. It prevents us from learning. We get caught up in what's going on in our own head, the story we're telling ourselves, and not in the experience. We fall out of a learning mode. We get preoccupied with performing. So emotion regulation in part is trying to keep your emotions in kind of that middle ground. Because it turns out very positive emotions hurt our learning as well. We're not paying attention to the cues we're seeing. We are not as observant about our own behavior, et cetera. So it's trying to just sort of, when you see yourself getting anxious, it would be kind of revisiting that you're trying some new things, that you're in a learning mode, that life isn't falling apart around you. You know, try to see the full picture rather than what we know happens when people feel emotions of threat is they narrow their visual field and they only focus on things that are consistent with that hypothesis that the world is threatening.
When I was interviewing Carol Dweck recently, I was asking her about the potential intersection between growth mindset and the practices of self-compassion, which haven't really been explored in the research to date, but I've certainly found in my own life have been hugely helpful to help me maintain that growth mindset. Again, as you're describing some of those emotional regulation practices, what was coming to mind for me was some of those practices of self-compassion. Do you think that can be valuable in this step to help us regulate our emotions?
Very much so. I think we overestimate the need to be perfect in this life. You know, that I think that, first of all, it's unachievable. And second of all, if everybody's preoccupied with their own performance, you know, these things that loom large for you often aren't even noticed by others. I will highlight another person's research. He's a psychologist here at Michigan, Ethan Cross. And he's found this very interesting set of findings around distancing. And that if you're thinking about, let's say you're in a month-long experience and you're worried about how things are going, that if you substitute thinking about this problem in the third person, what should Sue do next, as opposed to the first person, what should I do next, all sorts of positive outcomes stem from that. Your anxiety goes down, your efficacy goes up, et cetera. I just think that's a fascinating finding that is very robust. He's found it in many different settings and with different tasks and so forth. So that would be one strategy, somewhat different than self-compassion, but certainly useful for getting a hold of your emotions.
It sounds like a great strategy to play with. I'm going to be trying that one out. So Sue, I know feedback seeking is also an important part of this action step in your research. What do we need to be doing as leaders for this step?
Yeah, this one is a bit difficult. There is a value in not just living in your own head and your own perception of how you're doing, but somehow figuring out how you are seen by others. And there's two different ways you can do it. You can just pay more attention to others and use your emotional intelligence to ferret out what they're thinking, how they're reacting. This is a strategy fraught with some danger. Right? There's a wonderful cartoon that I often show that shows the CEO and the thought bubble over his head is, we're running low on pencils. And around the table, you see everyone's interpretation of him. He hated my idea. I'm too old for this organization. The company's going under. You know, and so you can monitor for feedback, but it's often difficult to get an accurate read of others' reactions. And so what I really recommend is that you figure out an effective way to ask for feedback, whether it's asking a closer friend and colleague who's at the meeting you're running, who's in the retreat. After the difficult conversation you hold with someone, you could cycle back and, for example, say, you know, I've been really working on my listening skills. I'd love your feedback on how I did in our conversation. We're so afraid of asking these questions. In our mind, we have this idea that it makes us look weak or insecure. But this is something I've researched quite a bit, and it's not how it appears to other people. In fact, it's associated with higher effectiveness ratings when managers seek feedback, especially when they seek negative feedback. And effectiveness ratings by everyone, their boss, their peers, and their subordinates. So I think we need to be less worried about how it'll look and more willing to ask and figure out how to ask, and this is probably the trickiest part, in a way where people will really tell you what they think. A lot of times we shy away from telling someone anything negative. And so one way to do it is, instead of asking me, how did I do, ask people, how might I get better? So, for example, you've had this difficult conversation with someone, you're working on your listening, circle back to that person and say, hey, you know, I'm working on being a better listener. Do you have any ideas for me on how I might improve? You're not necessarily asking for feedback based on that conversation, but certainly that person will be using what they observed in that conversation to give you ideas. And in that way, you can get feedback that you can subsequently reflect on when you reflect on the experience.
So Sue, I know the last step in your mindful leadership process is reflection. And you note in your research that this is often managers' least favorite activity. So why do managers tend to struggle so much with this step?
So yes, managers are very quick to say, we don't have time to reflect. Studies of managerial work attest to the fact that they run around like maniacs from meeting to meeting, call to call. But there's nothing to say that that is endogenous to the job itself. Those studies might just show managers' preference for running around like nuts, et cetera, and not reflecting. It's actually, this preference is backed by scientific study. This one is quite humorous. People are asked, which would you prefer, to spend 15 minutes alone with your thoughts or receive an electric shock from a 9-volt battery? You know, just your typical choice that psychologists give you. And the funny thing is, 67% of men and 54% of women choose to zap themselves rather than be alone with their thoughts.
That's amazing.
Yes. One man jolted himself 190 times. This is a man who does not like being alone with his thoughts. But it's interesting, the research is starting to show the value of such reflection for subsequent task performance and for leadership, where you have to get up and above all the chaos that comes at you through your inbox so that you can be thinking longer term, thinking, synthesizing, and thinking generally. There was an article in this Sunday's New York Times by David Leonard, who talked about George Shultz when he was Secretary of State. He liked to carve out 1 hour each week for quiet reflection. And David Leonard was talking about why all leaders would benefit from a Shultz hour, which definitely resonates with what we're talking about here. But in this case, if you want to do mindful engagement to learn from your experience, your reflection is much more tailored to, what did I observe about myself in this experience? Have I grown on this goal regarding this goal, or do I need to keep working on it? What is the feedback I've received suggesting? What throws me off track? And starting to get a handle on those things so that you could be ready for them in subsequent experience. So it's kind of thinking systematically about what just happened, why did it happen? What role did I play in it so that you can learn the most from it? If you don't reflect, you're really not getting the benefit of experience as a teacher of leadership because you're not synthesizing those experiences and tying them to more general patterns.
So I think those are great tips for us. Are you ready for the lightning round?
I'm a little scared, but I'm ready.
Buckle up. Here we go. So if we take mindful leadership as a given, I'm wondering what else has been the most useful research-based insight, tool, or learning that you've applied in your own life and why?
There's a study by my former doctoral student, Adam Grant, and Jane Dutton that asked people, how can you be a contribution? And I just love that. I love that study. It's something I ask myself all the time, whether I'm in a leader role and I'm currently the chair of our department, or in groups where I'm not the leader. How can I be a contribution to what's happening here or to the goals of this group or the processes we have in play? It puts me in a leader mindset right away, but in a way where I don't have to negate your leadership. And it makes me feel positive about my day-to-day activities.
I think that's a great question for us to be asking. Sue, is there a book in particular that you'd recommend people read when it comes to bringing out the best in people in workplaces?
So I'm going to recommend a book that's part of a book series, and it's something that your listeners may not be aware of. It's a book series written by the fellow who started what's now an iconic deli here in Ann Arbor called Zingerman's. And Zingerman's is a deli. It's a mail order food place. He and his partner have now created a whole suite of businesses, but their goal isn't to go nationwide. Their goal is to stay in Ann Arbor and do a bunch of different things. So he has a bakehouse and a coffee, not a brewery, but creator where they create the beans. And he has a creamery and two different restaurants. Anyway, it's very exciting for us here in Ann Arbor. The founder, Ari Weinzweig, has written a couple of the best books on leadership that I think are out there. And I'm going to recommend one. It's called A Lapsed Anarchist's Approach to Being a Better Leader. And he writes about what he did in this company that went from a very small startup to really a very admired company, and what he did as a leader and what he learned along the way. And I love it. It's very relatable. Frontline managers just love it. This organization now has a whole training arm, Zing Train, where people come to Ann Arbor to be trained by Ari and his partner, Paul, or by, you know, their people. So I recommend this book, A Lapsed Anarchist's Approach to Being a Better Leader.
I love that title, and I'm going to go grab it and have a read of it as well. So what are you reading right now, and are you enjoying it?
So I read all the time, but I read mostly articles that 90% of the world would think are incredibly boring, but I find them pretty exciting. So I'm not sure any recommendation I would make would be wildly or broadly popular, but I just read a wonderful article on liminal experience in contemporary careers. And the set of ideas is about liminal means you're not in and you're not out. And it's about more and more of the roles that people will play with respect to work, where they don't work for an organization, they work for themselves, but they're kind of part of an organization because they contract. And how do we manage our work identities in this kind of a career? I found it fascinating.
I think many of us would find it fascinating, Sue. So lastly, if there was one thing you wished everybody thought about when it comes to bringing out the best in themselves and others in workplaces, what would it be?
I would say it's start with yourself and don't give up or forget about or forget to own your own power, your own agency. If you can't lead anyone else, lead yourself to a better life. When that former Army officer said, leadership in everything I do today, I think he meant pursue my goals. Don't get distracted. Don't spend my day on Facebook. Don't spend my day responding to everyone else, but pursue what I want to achieve. And I think all of us can kick ourselves into that mode. And I think the world would be better off. I think we'd all accomplish more and create the world that a lot of us want to see in organizations more often.
I completely agree. Sue, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure.
And thank you for listening. For more information on Sue's wonderful work and other tested practical ways to bring out the best in people in organisations, be sure to check out the Positive Business Conference coming up on May 11 and 12 by visiting positivebusinessconference.com. And as always, we'll be sure to put these links into the show notes for you. You've been listening to Making Positive Psychology Work with Michelle McQuaid. For the notes from today's show and more tested practical ways to help people move from functioning to flourishing at work, be sure to head on over to michellemcquaid.com and grab our free wellbeing toolkit packed with how-to tips, tools, and interviews with the world's leading positive psychology researchers. And if you'd like to perform a random act of kindness today, then share this podcast with a friend or colleague to help improve our workplaces. After all, as Helen Keller wisely said, alone we can do so little, together we can do so much. Until next time, take care.